Okay, maybe let's start. So let me try to emphasize, try to review a little bit what we did in last class. So this is maybe it's the most convenient, maybe the key point in the last class can be explained in a simpler situation, which is a situation described by this homework problem. So let's describe this homework problem a little bit. Usually, when we discuss a particle with momentum, we just say, okay, the particle momentum is move around. That's it. And if your particle have a spin, then that's fine. The particle move around, and then spin just keep pointing the same direction all the time. But however, when you have so-called spin orbital coupling, then there are situations where, because energy, the spin and the momentum are locked. So you could have a situation that if a spin is parallel to the momentum, the energy is lower. That describes a lower band. If a spin is the opposite to momentum, you get another energy that's higher band. If you stay within the lower band, then the spin and the momentum are locked, always pointing the same direction. You say, so what? Just a spin pointing with the momentum is a slave of momentum. You're just using momentum to describe it. But I mentioned the last time, as the momentum move around, you can see the px, py. If a momentum can make a turn, the spin has to make a turn. When the spin making turns, you're involving overlap, because when you're calculating this phase space Lagrangian, you want to calculate overlap of wave function at time t and at time t plus delta t. But when the spin make turns, you'll encounter this overlap of a spin wave function. So let's call the spin. In one direction, with a spin in another direction. Sorry. It's a spin, direction of spin is vector dependent on time. And this one, in general, is not equal to one. This one is non-trivial. Give you some kind of phase, maybe delta phi. This phase we call the Barrett phase. And this Barrett phase will enter into the phase space Lagrangian in a non-trivial way. And that will affect dynamics. So actually, the dynamics of this kind of a particle do not obey Newton's law. They obey a modified Newton's law. So that is a question. So in this homework problem, you can see this phenomena in a much simpler situation. In the last class, we discussed a more complicated situation, which is a particle moving in a crystal. And we have a situation that each unit cell have many sites. So as a result, there's many band. Then we have a many band, we have a similar situation that's, if particle moving inside a particular band, at this place, then this particle have a basically this plane wave. But however, its probability weights on different sites in the same unit cell, because each unit cell have some different sites. But the weight of particle on this different site in the unit cell can be different. And they may depend on the momentum. At k and k prime, the amplitude on these three sites may be different, may change around. And this very much like a spin, It's a so we have this internal wave function, this psi alpha we introduced last time. And its component describe what is the amplitude on different sublattice. And then as k move around, this weight change around almost just like a spin rotate around. And so we have same phenomena that's this so therefore, this wave, internal wave function depend on the momentum, and that's just like spin will affect the dynamics. So the new dynamics is written in this Lagrangian equation. Word is a D. Dij is basically is the crystal momentum and where the CI is equal to, I think it's I. So basically, this is results. Okay. So let's come to C. So C is actually a vector, but it's leaving the K space. It's a function of K. It's a vector, but a function of K. It's obtained by from this wave function for each band. Each band we have this eigenvector. We depend on K. So this n-component column vector. So we make a derivative of this n-component column vector. You get another column vector. It's overlap with this diagram of the original vector. Give you something. And this something certainly depend on whether you make derivative with respect to kx, ky, so you get a vector. So we call C. The reason we call C is that vector potential is A. Its field strength is B. So follow that this vector potential in K space is C, its field strength is D, it's A, B, C, D. And so this is so since we have some vector potential in K space, we just follow the tradition, we can define the field strength in K space. It's really the it's a derivative vector potential respect to K now, because in K space. And we anti-symmetrize it. Basically, it's just a partial C I C K, then a partial K, we just anti-symmetrize and I K, just is anti-symmetrize. Then we get anti-symmetric tensor, which is we call the D. And usually we convert this anti-symmetric tensor into the vector using this epsilon symbol. So we can define the D K using epsilon K I J and the D I J. So we can, in three dimension, we can convert anti-symmetric tensor to vector. And this is usually this kind of vector is what we usually call magnetic field. So this is a kind of magnetic field, but in a K space. Okay. And so actually this C will enter into the phase space Lagrangian. And using this phase space Lagrangian, which is affected by C, we can re-derive the equation motion. We find equation motion indeed have a correction due to this a phase space vector potential, a phase space magnetic field. And so the K space magnetic field would enter the equation motion in this strange way. They modify the definition of velocity. Usually velocity is a gradient partial epsilon partial K. So now the velocity have this actual correction. And we have this actual correction, this whole equation motion is no longer in a Newton's form. It's just some other form. So it is something can happen. Okay. So today we'll try to discuss what is the consequence, what is the experimental consequence of this actual term. Because we claim that in a semiconductor, what is semiconductor? Semiconductor basically you have some energy band. You have a few electrons in the band moving around. That may give you conductivity, some phenomena. So therefore, whether something measurable in a semiconductor would allow us to see whether this particular semiconductor contain this correction or not. And maybe some phenomena need to be explained using this kind of correction. So that is the thing. And so one thing we can do is the following. So let's consider the conductance. Okay. And as I mentioned that to understand the conductance in semiconductor, we simply need to understand how electron moves and the influence of electric field. And we already mentioned that, well, when you have a band, you push electron, then this electron just keep moving. You get oscillating currents. But then I also mentioned that this is something never happens. We wish we observe that, but we won't see that. Because we always have frictions in semiconductors. And because of frictions, when electron get high energy, the friction try to bring electron back to low energy. The friction is the form of dissipation. It's trying to scatter the energy away and make something have a lower energy. Like a rolling downhill, a tendency to rolling downhill. Okay, so this is a friction. And because in the material, the friction is pretty strong. So therefore, for using ordinary electric field, we can never push this electron all the way across the band top and to see the oscillatory behavior. And before electron reached band top, the friction already bring them back to the bottom. And so therefore, the transport or conductivity we see in the ordinary material, like metal, is a competition between this electric force, try to drive electron, move electron in some one direction, and the dissipation, which try to stop electron from moving. Yeah, that's a, so this is a, this competition with two effects. So therefore, we have to introduce the friction. And it's pretty easy for us to introduce the friction because this equation motion, this is a force. So therefore, it's very natural for us to modify our equation motion. So now I'm using the electric field. So this is the first term electric field. Then we can add a friction term. We call this gamma inverse and velocity. So this is a friction force. And then we do this. Let me. Okay. Let me explain this first. Then I try to explain this. This term is pretty simple. You know, this is a force, and this is a negative force, but in the direction. This friction force is a point in the direction opposite to the velocity. They try to stop electron from moving. So this is a. And what is this term? This term used to be partial epsilon, partial k. And here I assume that the particle mostly near the bottom of band. So it's kind of quadratic. Okay. So therefore, near the quadratic, in the bottom band, this epsilon can be expanded as some matrix we call M inverse matrix, IJA with 1/2, KI, KJA. So we just do the quadratic expansion. And this M inverse is just a coefficient in this quadratic expansion near the bottom band. And certain plus a constant term. But constant term, we don't care. And so if we approximate the dispersion relation as some kind of quadratic form, then partial epsilon partial k became this. We assume k is small. Okay. So then that's it. So this will be situation including the friction. We want to understand how electron moves, after we understand how electron move around, we can understand how this d appear in the equation motion and how D affect the conductance. So that is the idea. But actually, there's a very interesting point here. Somehow, I don't like this. I don't like this. So this is a model. You know, the friction is a very complicated process. We don't understand it. Basically, when electron move around, it's a hit the atoms may excite some phonons and the electron may slow down a little bit. So extremely complicated process. And when something is very, very complicated, we sometimes say, oh, maybe it's simple. We're just assuming something very simple. Maybe something very complicated after averaging all those complicated phenomena, you get something very simple. So this is a kind of wishful thinking. You know, at the end, we get something very simple. But this is a model. So we tried using this something which is opposite to the velocity to model the effect of this complicated process. So very natural is slow down. But however, in this case, it may not be as natural as usual because of this term, because this correction. You can say before, in the usual case, if you don't have a d term, something opposite to the velocity is something you'll go downhill. Look at this. The velocity is a gradient of energy respect to k. So you ask, in which direction I will go downhill fastest? Well, that's given by partial e partial k. That happens to be the direction of velocity, or opposite velocity. So therefore, in that case, we can understand why friction has to be opposite to the velocity, because that's the way you go downhill straightforwardly. You just along the fastest slope, you try to go downhill. So if you're using that kind of a picture, I should say the friction should be minus gamma inverse, something go downhill would be this. Whatever, up is over, okay. And usually these two are the same, so it doesn't matter. But now these two are different. Okay, so this is almost like a research problem now. I don't know how to model it. This is like cultural, because so why you say friction is opposite to velocity? Because my high school teacher told me so. And but when you're thinking more, you say maybe it's more reasonable to say the friction is opposite to the gradient of the energy respect to k. Maybe this is a more reasonable modeling. That's the point. So this is really again, that this kind of thing all over in physics. Since many phenomena too complicated to describe exactly, we just don't know how to. So first, we just make a guess, okay? And but I hope you make some reasonable guess. And I don't know, actually, maybe this one is reasonable or this one is not reasonable. But at the moment, I feel this one may be more reasonable. I really don't know, actually. But on one hand, it's very interesting because this became an issue. And maybe you can develop theory based on these two assumptions. And I try to compare to experiments and to see which assumption would fit experiments better. Then you will see, yeah, maybe experiment tell us really this one or really this one. So actually in the lecture notes, I present the calculation for both case. And indeed, the consequences are different. But here I only present the calculation for the second case, which the consequence I feel is more reasonable. Yeah. So that is, but this kind of thing is very, happen a lot in physics. You need to make a guess. Then you try to think about physics, about your guess. Hopefully your guess is kind of reasonable. And then you compare to experiment to see whether your guess is correct or not correct. So that is a thing. So let's so now let's using the second way to do friction. But once you make a guess, the rest is mathematics. It's no longer fun actually. Just do the calculation. Once you make a right assumption, then just plug in and do the calculation. So let's just plug in and do the calculation. So here I will try to write down the matrix form. So we'll have a k dot equal to e minus gamma. So this M inverse is regarded as a matrix, and this k is like a vector. So this matrix acts on the vector. So using this matrix form. So here I already, so this one actually is this partial epsilon. Partial k. Okay. Then we have this again. This again in the matrix form. We have this. We have this form. But the k dot is this. So we just plug in. That should be. Okay, Okay, and then we assume this then we assume this E is oscillatory. So when E is oscillatory, we can replace this k dot as a minus I omega k equal to E zero and gamma m inverse k. So we get some kind of algebraic equation. So with a fixed frequency, we no longer have a differential equation. And similarly, this also became algebraic equation. Okay, so it's a so this one was became a minus I omega x dot, you know, for this frequency. And okay, and then after collecting things together, so I will not really repeat it. We just get the following thing: the x dot became E gamma 1 minus I omega D M 1 minus I gamma omega M inverse E zero. So this just after pretty lengthy calculation, you know, no doubt. Oh yeah, this is a dot. Yeah, it have a dot. It's a okay. Yeah. So this is a after some lengthy calculation, you get this. Okay. Basically, you know, what you find is actually very simple. From here, we see how the k relate to the e. Then just plug in here, and you get something only depend on E, because K is already depend on E, which is obtained from there. Yeah. Okay. So what? So let's look at when omega to zero. If omega to zero, this x dot is equal to E gamma E. That's when omega to zero. When omega is zero, that's the DC case. We don't have oscillatory field. We just have a constant electric field, and we keep driving it. And we see that because of friction, the particle reaches some kind of final velocity. So where the friction force and the electric force kind of balance, that's usually what we say. Okay, so we need to get these familiar results. And the interesting to see that the D drop out. This D don't enter. So somehow, if you do a DC measurement, we don't see the effect of this D. We don't see this effect if you do a DC measurement. I don't know whether that's true or not. This became a very interesting issue. If you do DC measurement, we don't see the effect. However, when the frequency is very high, if frequency is very high, much higher, you know, so that this combination, this is a matrix, basically D is also a matrix, M is a matrix. When this combination is much bigger than one, we can drop the one. When you drop the one, something interesting happens because this M and this M inverse canceled. So the X dot at the high frequency became E. Something universal do not depend on the gamma. Yes.
Was this observed in experiments?
Huh?
Was this observed in experiments?
I don't know. This is a. I haven't really gone through this experiments. The random experiment will be anomalous quantum anomalous Hall effect. Mm-hmm. I mean, not quantum, just anomalous Hall effect. And but from this we will see that remember this D is anti-symmetric tensor, you know, and so maybe you can write this in the component form be I equal to E, D I J, E J. you know. It's anti-symmetric tensor, that means if E in x direction, and this D only xy non-zero, x x equals zero. So if E is x direction, xy is non-zero, so that means the current will be in the y direction. It's a transverse. Because D is anti-symmetric, so this is like a transverse response. So if you have oscillatory field in x direction, we generate oscillatory motion in the y direction. It's transverse. It's kind of like a Hall effect, actually. And but somehow at high frequency, we see this Hall effect. And but this is universal. It do not depend on the friction. It's directly depend on this barrier curvature, this magnetic field in K space. So using high frequency, we can directly measure the magnetic field in K space. Yeah. So that is the phenomenon. Okay, but. Yeah, that's basically one result. Okay. However, the real situation in experiments is more complicated than this. So let me describe what situation we describe, what is situation in a real experiment. The situation we describe basically is just one particle in a band. And you say, and the electric field and the influence electric field, how this particle move around, you know, that is the picture we described. So then we can push it. We say maybe two particle is also fine. We just add effect two particle. Okay. So two particle is fine, or maybe three is fine. So as long as we have a few particle, they kind of don't interfere each other, this picture should be okay. We just add the effect of each particle, then that's it. Okay. However, when we have a, but in semiconductor, actually this is the case. In a semiconductor, each band only have a few particles. So actually this really worked for semiconductor. And for the metal, things are very different. For the metal, actually, we have a lot of electron, which really kind of fill the band halfway. You know, most metal, you just fill the band halfway. The band is really half filled. And this Pauli principle would play big role here. So those this single energy level is occupied by spin up and spin down electron at the bottom band. They cannot move around. It's just they squeeze by other electron. And then near the so-called Fermi surface. Then if electron move around, so this electron can move to the empty orbital. So electron near the Fermi surface can move around. And this will be the topic for the next week, actually. So here I just describe a little bit the situation. So therefore, when we consider the motion of electron or conductance of electron, looks like electron deep inside is a field energy level do not contribute. Only electron near the Fermi surface contribute. And so we should have a theory which capture this picture. The electron, only electron near the Fermi surface contribute. And the conductance should only depend on the electron near the Fermi surface, do not depend on the electron deep inside. There should be something like that. And so in the following, we'll try to develop so-called Boltzmann equation approach. It's really try to capture this phenomena. So this Boltzmann equation approach can really apply to this situation. Certainly it can also apply to the situation with a few electrons. But it can apply to a situation where we have a lot of electrons. And then you can have a more accurate way, a more correct picture to see how conductance happen in the material. Yeah. So this is what we are going to do. And in the Boltzmann equation approach, we have to use equation motion at certain stage. And then here, we have to use this modified equation motion. So then we get this conductance of a material, which you may have this K-space magnetic field. Okay, what is the idea of the Boltzmann equation? In the Boltzmann equation approach, the most important thing is this a distribution function. What the meaning for that? The meaning for this distribution function tell us the number of a particle in some space-time volume. But in the K, also in the space volume and in the K space volume. So we have this 2 power over 3 normalization, and this is G. So this is a definition, this almost definition. So if you know the G as function of R and K, this tell you in this space volume of a dr cube, we have many particles. And how many particles? Well, the particle will be equal to this. Let me do this. That's how many particles we have in this space volume. We have the integral over all possible momentum. Because some particle in this space volume have a large k, some have small k. Their distribution in k is described by this k dependence. Okay. If you integrate the k, then we get number of particles in the space volume, regardless their k value. But so this GRK is a more refined distribution. It's a distribution in K space and in the real space. So tell you in the volume of a delta R in space and the volume this delta K in the K space, how many particles do you have? So this is a number. So that is the meaning. Yes. Right now we ignore the spin index. So we either we assume there's no spin, or we just count just kind of we say the spin up, spin down have the same distribution. You mix them. We don't distinguish it. But you have very, very good point. When you consider spin 1/2 particle, when the spin is important, you need to add a spin index. You know, so the actual index. And right now we ignore the spin, so we don't have that to make life a little bit simpler. So this is already pretty complicated.
But does this rely on some kind of approximation that K is a good
quantum number within that little box? Yeah, this is a very good point. So basically, this concept is against of quantum mechanics. Because we assume there are such thing as some particle with a given position and a given momentum, we assume they are both well defined. And that's a lie, actually. So actually, this becomes very interesting. If you want to, if your space volume and the K volume are so small, then things may break down. So certainly mathematically, we say dr means infinitesimal. We have infinitesimal space volume and infinitesimal K volume. Well, if you assume that picture, the whole thing just falling apart. So here we also use a dr dk. We still assume that dr times dk is much bigger than h bar. So we have a rough resolution. You know, that's a physicist. You know, we say that we have small volume, but small volume. I mean, actually, 0.1 millimeter is pretty small, and usually, if you know, for that kind of spatial volume. This condition very easy to satisfy. H bar is very, very small. Okay. Anyway, so this small doesn't mean infinitesimal. Does not mean infinitesimal. It means some small thing, but bigger than H bar. Okay, and so once we have this distribution, again, this is a naming. You know, once we introduce this concept of the distribution. we can start to develop our theory. You know, before you introduce this, you don't know where to start. But once you introduce this proper concept, you can develop your theory. So I feel this, maybe this joint distribution in K and R space is the most important concept in the Boltzmann equation. Once you have that, other things just basically follows, then become mass. Okay, and so once we have this concept, next question is that we want to see how this how distribution evolve in times. To understand how distribution evolve in time, we have this equation. This equation describes how distribution evolve in times. Okay, what that means? It means the following. Suppose we have a dr cube. Okay. And we have a lot of particle in this phase space. You know, R and K are really phase space. Okay. And that's at time t. Then at another time, maybe minus t. Then this particle kind of, you know, coming from the other region. Maybe let me just draw this. I shouldn't draw this way. Probably let me draw the other direction. Okay, coming from the other region. Okay. And so because this particle don't appear, disappear. They have to evolve from one region to another region. So therefore, the number of particles in the two regions is the same. So that's one point. Then there's another point, actually, the volume. The volume is also the same. So this using this volume, we use this Liouville's theorem, actually. The motion in the phase space have this property. The phase space volume can change its shape, but not changing its volume. The phase space region can change its shape, but not its volume. Okay. And it have a quantum origin. That is, you know, each phase space volume representing available state in that volume. You know, and so this available states can never disappear. That's unitarity of quantum mechanics. So this unitarity in quantum mechanics led to the Liouville theorem, which is the phase space shape can change, but their volume don't change. Because this n number of particle n is the same, and the volume is the same, although shape changes. So actually, that means g is the same. So this led to a very simple relation that is d dt g equal to zero. Yes? That's right. And this is a magic. Actually, if someone's smart, after they realize the Liouville theorem, they may discover quantum mechanics through Liouville theorem. But they didn't. You know, this. Liouville theorem tells us something's conserved. You know, somehow phase space can deform whatever, but its volume cannot change. It seems to suggest there's something, each volume contains something in it which cannot increase or decrease. And only after quantum mechanics we know the thing which cannot decrease or increase is the number of states. It's basically a Hilbert space dimension is constant of motion. And so, I don't know. Yeah, this is to me, I say, so basically this is very important because you know, right now we derive the phase space Lagrangian via quantum mechanics. So we started the quantum theory, we have to describe the phase space Lagrangian and the classical motion from quantum mechanics. So therefore, the resulting phase-space Lagrangian naturally have this kind of a Liouville theorem, because they all come from quantum mechanics. So basically, Liouville theorem became a law within the classical physics, but they're coming from the quantum physics. Its origin is in quantum physics. Yeah. So this is a, but what this really means, this really means falling. You know, this G is function of R, K, and T. But R and K is a function of a T because of equation motion. So the D really means I time due with respect to this T, and this T, then whole thing becomes zero. And that's all. So this is a, so this is a how the distribution function evolves. So this is a, so this became very nice, because you have distribution function, you know how each particle evolves in time. That's this RT, KT determined by the equation motion, exactly from that equation motion. Once you know how RT, TK, KT depend on time, you can plug in this equation, and this differential equation will tell you how G evolve in time. Yeah. Okay. So the equation motion, I can rewrite this equation motion, is equation between partial G, partial T. So this is really the D, DTG. So this is a one of the most important equation. And okay, velocity. Okay, let me do this way. K dot. So this is a, this is, this describe how distribution evolve. Okay. And but there's a problem. Where is the friction? We don't have friction. I say, okay, we have friction. We can describe friction by adding the friction force in the equation motion. But actually, this is not what we want to do. We do not want to do that. Because in this picture, we have a better way to model friction. So we have a different model of friction now. You can see over there, we're using something against of a gradient for epsilon to model friction. And here, we can model friction in a more, I hope, in a more realistic way. So it's here how to model. Because suppose we have a particle. We have some kind of distribution. And this distribution we call the G0. G0 actually is a distribution, equilibrium distribution. That's it. And a certain temperature, things get equilibrated. So actually, the equilibrium distribution is given by the Fermi distribution, which is a function of a K and energy. So let me just write it down. 1 plus e to the, I think, plus temperature beta epsilon minus chemical potential. So for the fermion, we have this Fermi distribution, Fermi Dirac distribution. I will not cover this. This is a statistical physics class. So there's some kind of standard distribution. So what the equilibrium means? Equilibrium means that the particle want to have this distribution. If you have a distribution which differ from this equilibrium distribution, the particle want to go back. You want to go back to equilibrium distribution. And this is another way to model the dissipation. The dissipation try to go back to equilibrium. And so we add an actual thing, because this is a, DGDT is how distribution changes. And without dissipation, we say they change just, I'll cut in this, just they don't change. But however, this if you have a scattering or some dissipation, we say they want to go back to equilibrium. So if you deviate from equilibrium, this is the term which try to decay into equilibrium, you know, dTdG equal to something like a g minus g zero with 1 over tau. You want to decay into equilibrium. And a tau is a decay time. If tau is big, it means it's slowly became equilibrium. It's a very weak effect. If tau is small, it means it quickly became equilibrium. So it's a very strong dissipation. So this tau is we call the relaxation time, describe how fast we reach equilibration. Okay. So this is the equation. And that's it. Actually, that's all. So this is the Boltzmann theory for transport. And we have the physics. You can see we have the key point is that we have a model for dissipation. It's called the relaxation time model for dissipation. And we're just adding this term to describe this complicated situation for dissipation. And once we have this, we got the equation, we can solve that, we got everything. So rest is math. Okay. So next, let me just carry through the math a little bit, and we'll see what happens. Okay, and so so here we will use the, let me try to see. Okay. So we call this delta G. Okay, yeah. So what we do here is actually pretty simple. We can see that from this equation. Okay, from this equation. We have this delta g, so some small deviation from equilibrium. We ask where this small deviation comes from. Well, it's come from because we have some velocity or we have some kind of force. Sorry, this is a dot. So this k dot is a force. We have some force, we have some velocity, and it may just change. Okay. However, we know that if we plug in the equilibrium distribution, okay, this equilibrium distribution will satisfy this equation. So if you plug in the equilibrium distribution, this equation will be satisfied. So this will be zero. So therefore, this non-zero delta g really coming from this as a first order effect. Basically, we try to say we can just put the g zero here as a first order effect. Okay, and. So let me show you what to say. because this, so maybe let's try again. Because this is like, for example, this is a force, okay. We want to see the linear effect of a force, okay. So suddenly we have a force, the force may change distribution, away, drive distribution away from G zero. So therefore this term, if you have a G here, this term would have a force. But however, for the linear term, if you only think about linear effect, we can put G zero here. And directly obtain this. So this is actually what we do. That's one thing. The second thing is that we want to study this this static case, the zero frequency case. So the static case means that there's no explicit time dependence. So this term is also equal to zero. But anyway, this term is equal to zero if you're using the equilibrium distribution like this. Okay, so with this with this, we see that this G minus G zero, or we call this delta G, is really equal to this partial G zero partial epsilon. Let me just write down this tau velocity and minus gradient of time potential plus the force. Okay, so we get these results. And you may ask how you get this result. So let's just do a few calculations. This is a partial G zero partial R is equal to this 1 over beta partial F partial epsilon and partial beta okay we have these results so this basic chain rules and it really says that not F sorry for notation G zero so basically it says that so there's a this is G zero depend on the position and the K only via this combination. And this epsilon actually is function of K. But the chemical potential can be function of R. So this is the key assumption here. So we imagine a situation, the chemical potential is not constant. It have a spatial dependence. So if time chemical potential have a spatial dependence, so then that's how this G zero have this spatial dependence. Yes?
You're considering just linear order. G zero satisfy Boltzmann's equation, right?
Yes.
So I don't see where that approximation leads you to that instead of leading you to G equals G zero.
The thing is that what happens is that let me see. Okay, so what I really following is, for example, so we are consider this term. Usually, for the real equilibrium case, the chemical potential should be constant. The chemical potential should be constant. That's a real equilibrium case. So actually, there's no contribution from here. But if chemical potential is not constant, that means we only have a local equilibration. Locally are equilibrates, but here and here they have different chemical potential. And because chemical potential is not really equilibrium, and this G zero want to evolve into something with a constant chemical potential. And this term describes that kind of force. If chemical potential is not constant, then the things would want to move around to make chemical potential equivalent, constant. And so that's like a driving from so deviate from G zero. That's like a force. So this is real external force, but this is a force due to non-uniform chemical potential. Yeah, very, very good question. Yeah. And so here actually here we are trying to describe it. You know, And remember, the only this new have R dependence. So this duty only just respect to new. Okay. So I will not really go too much further. And this term just became this the first term. That's all I want to say. Okay. And then we have this second term. We have this term. Since K dot here, K dot really is a force. So this term basically is a force. External force term. But then we need to calculate this derivative. So what is the derivative? This partial G0, partial K. Again, it's a it's really partial F, partial epsilon, partial K. Again, it's Again, the G0 depend on K only via this epsilon. So we get something like that. And this term became this partial G0, partial epsilon. Then we have this and this term is what we know is as is a became a VK, became velocity minus this D times K. So D is a matrix. So here I use a relation over there. You know, the partial epsilon partial K is a velocity minus DK. DK dot, I'm sorry. It's DK dot. There's a dot there. DK dot. Oh, I kind of dropping that dot. There's a dot there. Okay. But DK dot is a force. DK dot is a force. Okay. And we want to drop that. Why I want to drop this force term? Because we are calculating this term. We already have a force term here. So if you have another force term inside this, this would be force square. That would be quadratic subleading term. And here we are only interested in the leading term. So we drop that force. So this is a little bit strange. You say, wow, this D term is dropped again. Don't even appear. Okay, we'll come back. Okay. And so if you do this, so this term would give us this contribution. Okay. And so I didn't really go through the math. I just described the steps, you know. We'll carry through this mass, and you will see this will come to become this. Okay. So, I think I make some mistake here. 1/2. Okay. Okay, yeah. That's it. So, yeah, I just want to mention that in the over there, I already moved this tau to this side of the equation. So that's why we have a tau over there. Yes.
So we allow the chemical potential to be spatially
dependent.
Is
yes.
There a reason that we don't allow it to depend on the momentum?
Chemical potential depend on momentum. That's probably by definition. We don't do that. We could make them depend on momentum, but by definition, the chemical potential is a value which is assumption that we say this the momentum distribution always have this form. It's not arbitrary. Have this form. But it's controlled by a value, a single value, which is a chemical potential. If you allow chemical potential to depend on K, that's basically say that I allow arbitrary distribution in the momentum. So this is not an assumption. We kind of assume that the equilibration in the local region, but with different momentum, happen very quickly. So therefore, in each local region, the particle distribution in the momentum is more or less fixed, have this Fermi-Dirac form. But somehow, the kind potential also want to be the same in different region. But that is a much slower process. Because in order for the kind potential to get equilibrium, we need to bring particle from this region to that region. And that is harder. When particle have a conservation, it's harder, it's slower. So this is, again, this question involving is have very deep physics in it. That is, there's a fast process and slow process. The fast process that is in the same region, but in a different momentum. And this scattering is very quick, very strong. You quickly equilibrate, and the distribution of momentum quickly reach this Fermi-Dirac form. But then there's a slow process where the kind potential in one region should be equal to kind potential in another region. That requires the transport of conserved particle. If particle can disappear, reappear immediately without conservation, then that will be also be a fast process. Then the nu will be immediately be a constant. But if particle have a conservation, then it's hard for nu to be constant. That's a slower process. And this Boltzmann equation is right, is something like let's average out the fast process before. Then here we describe the slow process. So what I'm doing here is describing the slow process. Yeah, it's a very important point, actually. So once we get this almost done, you know. This is the results. This is G0 is something known. If you know the dispersion relation, you know the kind potential, we know this. Okay. Then this velocity is what we have over that expression over there. That's from equation motion. And this is change of kind potential. You can see there's a force here. But this force, there's some effective force. Effective force is not external force. It's a combination of a gradient of kind potential and the force. So this is something we already learned, something quite interesting. The motion of an electron in a solid is not driven by external force alone. It's driven by some combined factor. This combination of external force and a gradient kind potential. This combined vector behave like effective force. This effective force drives things around, basically. Okay. And so when you say Ohm's law, you say the current is proportional to something, voltage. The voltage really is this combination, not external electric field. It is combination of a change kind potential and the external electric field. And this drives something like current. So current is proportional to this combination. So that is that's one thing where they learn. Okay. So the last we just so once we have this, the next thing will be very simple. We just need to compute the currents. Because this result basically, let me rewrite this result. This result basically means that the distribution equal to this plus the equilibrium one. So I can rewrite this in the following. So if you know the force, you know the gradient for time potential, then you know what should be the static distribution. This is a static distribution, which is a kind of steady state. Okay. And so to see how much electric current induced by some kind of external electric field or gradient kind potential, we just need to evaluate the currents. And the currents, so to evaluate the currents, let's do the following thing. Okay, we already say that so the number of particle, we already say that the density of a particle at R is equal to this D cube. Okay. Where they say that? Okay. Yes. It will, and that's very, very good question, and you need to do a little bit more. It's this approximation. So, thank you for asking this question. So what happens, suppose if you apply electric suddenly, you know, then you first, so let's just draw, you have this time, this is a distribution. Okay, originally you have some distribution. When you apply some electric suddenly, you get distribution don't change immediately, but the distribution would change. You drive distribution to another distribution. And then it may wiggle a little bit, you know, they may overshoot, may oscillate a few times, or maybe not. They will settle down to a new distribution. And this new distribution is what we call the steady state distribution. So here we basically study this part only. Because it's already steady state, so in this distribution, there's no time dependence. However, to study transient, we apply a sudden change, how all the distribution switch into new distribution, and there's a region called transient region. And in this region, you have to include this. And then it's mathematically doable. You can just do it. It's just more complicated. So here we consider a simple case. So we only study these steady states. So this allows us to say there's no explicit time dependence. Then what is a steady state distribution? It's like you have a particle with a friction. We'll suddenly apply a force, it would accelerate. But eventually it will reach a final velocity. We only study the value of final velocity as a function of a force, you know, but not study how the x-ray reach final velocity, just what is final velocity. So here is that we just study the final distribution due to driving, not how they change the final distribution. Yes.
However, you were talking before about the competition between this friction force and the force that I'm driving the system with.
Yes.
The question is, there exists this steady state or this finite state at the end, because if I just drive it with the force, there's a probability that the system will recover its initial state, right?
Yes.
So this steady distribution that we have here does exist?
Exists. So what happens is not, we don't have friction force anymore, but however we have this kind of this tendency to go back to the G zero. But however, we also have other tendency to drive it away from G zero. So the balancing of the two give you something slightly deviate from G zero. You know, this is a force trying to go back to G zero. But when you drive it, you try to make distribution different from G zero. And the competition, the balance of the two give you something different from G zero, but the difference is proportional to the force. So like a response, it's a linear response.
So if the force is time dependent, let's say.
If force is time dependent, you have to include this term.
Right, and then I'll have the competition between the two time scales that I have.
That's right. This will be very interesting. Yeah. So if a force is time dependent, then you have to include this term. So that's really that's the AC part. Actually, what you talk here, like here we have time dependent. This is the AC part. To understand this AC part, we cannot do what I did. We have to really include this term and do other things. But it's doable. It's nice to do the AC part. You get AC response. But here we only consider DC response. And so certainly one thing you want to ask is following. You know, well, remember what you try to get is that we want to see whether there's some response which is C the D or not. And here we already see that in this theory, we see that the AC response can see D, but the DC If omega equals to zero, there's no D dependence over there. So we need to have a AC to see the D. And here it looks like we are getting the same result. You can see at the linear order, there's a D effect. D coming from here, they kind of drop out. There's no D here. So it looks like we don't have any D dependence in the DC response. But actually, we all see that we do have a D dependence in the DC response. Actually, it's right, coming right here. And here I just explain what the meaning of G is, that if you integrate over K, we get a density. That is the meaning of a distribution. Okay. And so how to get the currents? How to get the currents? Okay, how to get the currents? The currents actually is a following. It's the same thing as this. It's almost like a density. So if you integrate everything, we get density. But current is like a weighted average. It's a weighted, it's, you have some weight. Because some particle may contribute to large current, some particle can contribute to small current, depend on their momentum. Remember, velocity depends on momentum. So some momentum have a contribute to large current, some momentum contribute to small currents. So we have to include the current contribution from each momentum, which is really just a velocity. It's a electric field times the velocity. So that's current. If every particle have the same contribution, we just get total number. If every particle have this EV, then after adding them up, you get this total velocity times E, which is given current density. So current density just equal to that. And that's almost everything, because this G is what we already derived here. It's just this term. If you plug in, you get everything. And here the and here I realize the magic happens, because this velocity is so okay, so let me just go one step further. So this one can become dk. Vk. Then we have a delta g plus dk. G zero, you have these two terms. You have these two terms. And this delta G term is what we don't, without the G zero, is this part. It's something due to the non-uniform time potential and due to the external force or due to external electric field. So that's the delta G part. Okay. But then we have this part. So usually this part equal to zero. Why this part equal to zero? Because of V. So let's consider this part. Because V is actually is a partial epsilon, partial k. And the G zero is a function of epsilon. So you have a so this whole thing is a derivative of some function of k. Some function, you know. And so maybe I shouldn't say this. This is not the right way to say this. Yeah, so let me try to see. Yeah, it's a let me see how to argue this. This yeah, the K, this one indeed. This integration is periodic, and indeed, and specifically, this is a. You can if you do the partial integral, let me see. If you do the partial, it's not really partial integral. I think this is really function of k. You have a something of function the derivative. Yeah, yeah. You basically you with this you can you know this whole thing indeed is just some function of some function for is some strange function of epsilon. You can really write it in this way. You just do the integration of epsilon, okay, and maybe better way to say it. I'm sorry. Okay. This is a D. Okay, let's do one dimension. It's much more clear. Just I'm confused by the higher dimension. In one dimension, is like this, and then it's really this D epsilon. G zero epsilon, so let me see, in one dimension, yeah, looks like I need to do this Oh yeah, actually there's a two parts. I think I'm sorry. This if you do this, I have to do this part and this part. Eventually they cancel out.
But,
yeah.
But isn't that zero just in an approximation where epsilon is precisely an even function of k? Because
yeah.
In that case, d epsilon dk is just an odd power.
Exactly. Yeah.
Funny.
Yeah. So this really says that for any equilibrium distribution respect to energy, in a usual way, you get a zero velocity. Yeah. But however, you can no longer use this because velocity is no longer equal to this. Velocity is not that. So actually, the velocity have another contribution. So this contribution is over there. So the first contribution includes zero, but the second contribution is dijk, k dot. Yeah. So because velocity is not just a partial epsilon partial k, but have this second term. And the second term have this. But the k dot j is a force. So actually it's an electric field. J. And that's it. So so let me just write down one step more. So then we can now we can plug this into here, and so this just became dk. Okay, and then we can we have this partial g zero partial epsilon, partial g zero partial epsilon and the v here. Okay, so then we get this e v I v j. And with a tau, and that's about it, I think. And then we have this combined force, maybe they call it EE. Okay, so that's the first term. The second term is just that. Let me not copy it. Okay, yeah, I forgot. There's one other thing. It's a partial G zero. Partial epsilon. Okay, that's about the story. Okay, let me try to make sure I get epsilon. I think there's a minus sign here. Okay. So let's consider second. This first term. What this means? This is Euro term. You know, in any textbook, you'll get this term. And this term have this factor, partial G0, partial epsilon. What that factor is? Remember, the diffusion is something like some states, energy level below nu is occupied, above nu is unoccupied. So therefore, this occupation number, so G0 in this region is a 1. Oh, sorry. Okay. Let me see which one. Yeah, G0 in this region is 1, and the G0 in this region is 0. So their derivatives are equal to 0. Only near the Fermi surface, this derivative, partial G0, partial epsilon, is non-zero. It's like a delta function there. So this partial G0, partial epsilon is like a delta function, which is non-zero only near the Fermi surface. And so therefore, this contribution only near Fermi surface. That's very expected. And then what is contribution? Then on the Fermi surface, you have these two velocity. You know, two velocity near Fermi surface. You do some kind of average of these two velocity, get a tensor. And put some E, put some epsilon there. Then that tell you how they respond to this this combined electric field and the gradient of a vector potential, a chemical potential. So that's so that is a form of this result of Boltzmann equation. And so in the standard textbook we get this term. That tell you how to compute the conductivity. So if I just write it. So let me just write this expression for the conductivity tensor. The conductivity tensor actually is GIGA is equal to, for the record, you may get some correct expression, tau E squared partial G0 partial epsilon, then the average of a velocity. So these are both a function of K, basically. And the minimum conductivity tensor is that this J I is equal to epsilon I J plus or times this minus gradient partial J potential and plus divided by E actually and put electric field here J. So basically they tell you this effective electric field drive the current, and the coefficient is this conductivity tensor. But here we have this, so now this is a new term is here. And this term is very, very interesting. This term actually is let's call that G0ij. But they only depend on this external electric field. They don't depend on the change of a chemical potential. They don't have this form. So they have a different dependence. So this is a combined effect. That's usual driving force. But however, this transverse current is not that. Transverse current only depends on the pure electric field inside the material. But it is a DC effect. So this is different from the previous calculation. So we see that there is a DC effect. But this becomes delicate. If your material have no electric field in it, only have a change of chemical potential, then the change in chemical potential can drive current, but only via the first term. To see the second term, you have to make sure your material have a external electric field in it. So there's a And so this is non-trivial thing. Okay, so that's actually this is what I learned. So what is this actual term? So let me just write down the actual term. What is this G zero? This new term. And from all this, we can see the following. So actually, this is my main result here. And there's a current here. There's a E here. I think I missed it. There's another E here. There should be another E. Okay. So it's really what happened. This is this epsilon zero ij. It's really equal to the E squared over H bar dk cube over 2m cube. And dij and the G0 distribution. So this is the formula. This is a string response only responding to the electric field. And you may say there's no H bar here. Yeah, I kind of sloppy because the velocity is really this partial epsilon partial p. So I here say velocity equals partial epsilon partial k. So they differ by H bar. So I basically doing computation assuming H bar equal to 1. So here I have to restore the H bar. So this is a more correct expression. And this will lead to the topic in next class. Because this expression looks quite interesting. Because if we have band which are totally filled, if a band is totally filled, that means G0 is always equal to 1 in the whole band. We should get insulator because look at the first term here. Yeah, look at this term. G0 always equal to 1 in the whole band. So it's a gradient respect to epsilon is 0. Because the compotential is much higher than the band top. So the every part of band is filled. So occupation is 1. So G0 equal to 1 for the whole band, certainly your derivative equal to 0. The whole thing equal to 0. So we obtain expect result. A filled band is insulator, have no conductance. A filled band. And the conductance appears only when you have a Fermi surface like this, where the filling from 1 changes to 0. And this kind of seashore, at edge, then this is non-zero, you have something. Without this step, you don't have anything. But this is no longer true for the second term. This is a D term. If G equal to 1, then we get the integration of this magnetic field over the whole Brillouin zone. And this is a famous number called the Chern number. And it's quantized. If you do that, this is always equal to integer. Amazingly, this is always equal to integer times 2 pi, I think, to be more precise. And
G naught is presumably equal to 1.
Yes. For the field band. Yes. For the field band. So if a band is not filled, then this G naught is equal to 1 for the filled part, 0 for the unfilled part. So you have some kind of integration with D, but only for the filled part. In that case, this integration is not quantized. But however, if the whole band is totally filled, then this integration is quantized, either equal to 0 or equal to 2 pi or something. And this is a phenomenon of integer quantum Hall effect. That is if you have some special band, that this band have a some kind of K space magnetic field, and its average, its integration is non-zero. Then because a theorem by Chern, then this this integration has to be some integer. And then this then you have a field band with non-zero Hall conductance. Yeah. And certainly non-zero, I really means that, you know, in two dimension, dxx equal to zero. Only dxy not equal to zero, you know, in two dimension. So I really means non-zero really means so dxy, this integration equal to integer times 2 pi. So you have this very strange quantized value for sigma xy. That is you drive a current, if you apply electric in one direction, the current goes to transverse direction. That's response. And so this became maybe the main result of this today's lecture is that indeed this the dxy can be measured in the DC measurement, but the requirement is that the electric field inside your sample has to be non-zero. It's not just change your time potential. It's electric has to be non-zero. Usually inside the metal, because screening effect, the electric field is zero. So it's a little bit tricky to see this. One has to design your sample in a particular way to make sure electric field is at inside the sample. Then you may see this effect. But on the other hand, I have to say that I'm not sure whether what I'm telling you is correct or not. They are based on a particular dissipation model, this relaxation time model. In the Boltzmann equation, we have this particular relaxation time modeling to model dissipation effect. That may not be correct, actually. And so when you have a D over there, and the dissipation may do something else, may have some other contribution, I'm not sure. But within this relaxation time model of a dissipation, we get these results. So it'd be kind of nice to see whether experimentally how one see that. Actually, this is a surprise to me. You know, I only discovered this while preparing this class. And so I wonder whether this is really, really true or not. Yeah. Okay, so in the next class, we'll come to this strange thing. We have a band whose integration for magnetic field in the K space is non-zero. So this represents a new kind of insulator, we call a Chern insulator. And we have a theory about that. Okay, I will stop here.